This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Jason DeRosso here. Welcome to The Screen Show on RN. Coming up today, a show that is packed to the brim with directorial talent. Steven Soderbergh, Melanie Laurent, who also acts in the movie that she's just directed, and the Emmy Award-winning director of The Crown, Jessica Hobbs, all coming up, as I say, packed to the brim. So let's just get started with Steven Soderbergh, one of the most prolific filmmakers in the world today. At the time of recording this show, in fact, he is about to present his new film at the Toronto Film Festival, a project that's shrouded in secrecy. I'm about to tell you about his current film, his previous film, which is called No Sudden Move. And it's a movie that was bumped out of cinema release and pushed to streaming video in Australia after the recent COVID lockdowns. It's a gangster film set in Detroit. It revisits the theme of underdogs fighting systemic corruption that we've seen before in Soderbergh movies like Aaron Brockovich and The Informant, and more recently in that movie about a basketball player's strike, High Flying Birds. If you haven't seen that yet, I do recommend it. Now, the golden rule of these plots is that characters always find out that they're more stuck than they first realize. And in this case, we're talking about, in particular, two characters in the center of the frame, played by Don Cheadle and Benicio Del Toro, a pair of unlikely underworld heavies. They're unlikely in their combination, I guess, because Benicio Del Toro is a kind of Goomba Italian-American. Don Cheadle plays this black criminal who's just out of jail, and he does not trust anyone, let alone these Italian mobsters who seem to be calling the shots. Although he has some bad karma with the local black mob as well. Now, the film delivers more twists than even his suspicious mind can anticipate. There are dirty deals afoot between, well, people high up in the city administration and people high up in the car industry, and Detroit's most vulnerable communities are in for a rough time. Ed Solomon's script is based on some pretty substantial real-world research, and the film, I think, will have an appeal for audiences who, well, enjoy thinking they know the dice are loaded, unlike the characters. I mean, it does flatter the audience a little bit. You could almost cue Leonard Cohen's Everybody Knows over the end credits. Now, I don't want to suggest that there's something banal about the observations made in this film, but it does matter how you deliver. Now, No Sudden Move is the first time Soderbergh has returned to Detroit since his thriller that he made in the late 90s, 1998, in fact, starring George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez, which was, of course, called Out of Sight. He is in a decidedly less romantic mood here. This film is about cranky men with diminishing options and swollen bodies, self-medicating from the top shelf and always a step behind where they need to be. We've seen Martin Scorsese breathe fresh air into these kinds of stories before, most recently, of course, in The Irishman. Soderbergh is not as nimble with these same types of ingredients. I mean, this isn't a film about gangsters who are as old as they are in The Irishman, but it is a similar kind of film in some ways. And Ray Liotta even arrives on screen at a certain point as a bloated, belligerent, wife-beating gangster. And at that point, I almost wanted to tap out because the film can sometimes feel unrelenting in its grimness. By the way, Liotta has a role in the upcoming Sopranos prequel, The Many Saints of Newark, as well. I'll be telling you about that in a couple of weeks. He plays two separate characters there. I think he's better in that film, but that film is not as good as this. No Sudden Move does have some fascinating things to say. It's also very well crafted and better crafted than most series television. But as well turned out as it is, I think it's treading down a very well-worn path. It is streaming on various platforms now, and Steven Soderbergh is coming up.
He says he can deliver the code book and guarantee you 50, maybe more, a lot more.
And what does he get?
Safe passage and $5,000 for himself.
So the 50 isn't really 50, it's 45.
At that price, ain't it worth more to just turn goings in to Joe Finney and that other guy, what's his name? Russo?
It's more like Capelli business.
Either way, what you want me to tell Goins?
Tell him I'll be there with pleasure.
Well, Steven Soderbergh, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, tell me about Detroit as this backdrop to this story, because it's so important. And of course, you've filmed in Detroit before, but it's been a while between drinks. The racial dimension to this story is so important, and particularly how that relates to black neighborhoods in the city and this process called quote-unquote urban renewal. I was fascinated by all of that. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that, I mean, that, I was aware of this kind of activity on the parts of governments and corporations over the decades, but I didn't know about the specifics of what happened in Detroit until we started developing the story. And the story developed in a kind of backwards way, in the sense that I went to Ed Solomon with a very simple idea of three men brought together to do a job and it goes wrong. Ed started doing some research. You know, when I asked the question, well, what's the MacGuffin? Like, what is the thing that everybody is trying to get, you know, that activates the plot? And Ed found this story about the catalytic converter and how it was developed in the 50s. And the big corporations just sat on it until somebody in the Justice Department later found out and asked them what was going on. And I thought, perfect. That's a great thing to be in a safe that somebody's got to crack into somehow. And that's kind of how we started. So we ended up in Detroit entirely by accident. The specifics in this case regarding these two huge neighborhoods that were completely, you know, dismantled and decimated was something I wasn't familiar with, and which impacts the city still. They never recovered. And you've still, but, and then in fact, not only did they never recover, but sort of in the intervening decades, anything that was kind of near this super highway superstructure that they built has experienced, you know, a decline. Like it's just very, it's corrosive.
Yeah, I mean, I like the way that, I like it when noirs, and you think of something like Chinatown, of course, which is a classic example, when they have this backdrop, which really, you know, interlocks with the foreground, I guess, intrigue. And, right. and that backdrop in this case is all about systemic corruption. You know, it's all about the city of Detroit and the way it's changing. And you think of the way you start the film with Don Cheadle's character kind of walking through the streets, this long sort of tracking shot. And I was thinking in a film with so many twists and turns and so many characters, I guess to me, Don Cheadle is the closest we get to maybe a good character or someone who might resemble an audience surrogate. How do you see his character?
Yeah, look, I do see him as, I think, good and bad, or the binary, you know, of that, I don't know, really applies to him or should apply to anybody, really. But in this case, it's clear at least that he has a certain, even more than having kind of a code, a personal code, even though he's a criminal that he kind of lives by, there is a specific task that he is attempting to accomplish. And it seems, you know, fairly thought out and important in his mind. And I think as an audience, when you have these meetings sometimes with executives or people, the financiers, and you're talking about character, and the question that they always throw out to you is like, what does this character want? And so the fact that it's, you know, what he wants is very clear, and he seems to be the smartest person in the story that we're watching, you know, when it comes to implementing his desires. So the movie was conceived with Don in mind to play that character, but Kurt, you know, it was designed for Kurt to be, you know, our vehicle for engaging with the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think he mentions really briefly, and this isn't a spoiler because it's earlier on in the film, but he mentions briefly he wants to get some land back that was taken from him. And that's kind of as much motivation as we need, but it sort of dovetails nicely with the rest of the themes, with some of those other background themes of these black communities slowly being displaced from their historic neighbourhoods in Detroit, which I found interesting. And the other thing that was interesting was the idea of, I guess, black organised crime and the notion that in Detroit, and Bill Duke's wonderful as this kind of kingpin figure, the notion that in Detroit, the black organized crime kind of resisted the influence of the white mob in bigger cities like Chicago, for example. I didn't know any of that sort of history. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, my understanding was that there was a very real form of detente between these gangs or groups, and that specific territorial skirmishes were not common. Like, there was a general consensus about who controlled what. This, if I'm not mistaken, there was also a fairly sizable Jewish gang that existed by the time our film takes place has started to be squeezed out. So when Don says, "See if you can get me a couple of those purple gang boys, if they haven't been run out of town," we're kind of on the back end of them kind of deciding that it wasn't working for them and they moved elsewhere. So it's a very, as you said, it's just a really rich period in the life of that city. And it is, and it also at the same time, you know, there are two other things going on. It's arguably during that period, the most American of all the American cities. I mean, it's the center of the automobile industry. We are all about cars. Like, we're all about cars. So in a sort of, you know, psychic, spiritual way, like, Detroit is the ultimate expression of like an American city in that time. And yet, look at what is underneath, what's happening underneath all that. When you talk about people who are not in positions of power, it was, like I said, just by circumstance, it turned out to be very, very rich. And the trick for Ed and I was to find this balance where, you know, none of this fascinating context confused you or distracted you from the main plot, which is, you know, find that document and get as much money for it as you can.
Yeah. Well, Benicio del Toro and Don Cheadle, I think, make a great pair at the center of this kind of crazy caper, really, that just keeps unfolding in bizarre ways. Benicio del Toro, of course, I guess nominally a sort of member of a kind of peripheral figure in the Italian organized crime scene. That's the character he's playing. But tell me a little bit about the film noir sort of clear influence on this film. Because in a way, I think, you know, if I think of something like The Good German, which was much more of a kind of almost a retro exercise, kind of deliberately so,
yeah.
This touches on film noir, but it doesn't really feel retro. I mean, I'd like to know about the camera rig you're using here and all the things that actually take film noir, I guess, in a contemporary direction with the way that you shot this. Tell me first about what you shot it with.
Well, I knew I wanted to recreate, I knew I wanted to shoot in CinemaScope. I wanted to use anamorphic lenses to put myself in the terrain of a certain kind of film from the 50s that I was watching and kind of building from. And the two primary films were both Nicholas Ray films. So it was Rebel Without a Cause and Bigger Than Life. These are, like I said, CinemaScope, bold angles, heavily saturated, lot of contrast, you know, just very, you know, in my mind, kind of classic Hollywood, you know, muscular filmmaking. And so that was what I was building from. But I wanted to take advantage of the fact that even using that grammar as a starting point, the lenses at that point, people couldn't get very close to them. The cameras were huge. You couldn't move the camera safely and quickly. There were just things that he couldn't do, even if he wanted to. I fortunately now live in an era where anywhere I want to put a lens, or any, if I say I want the camera to go from there to here, it can be done. So I wanted to take advantage of that while not, but you know, while staying in lockstep with what he had done. So we found these lenses. It's made by a company called Koa, and they've kind of leaned into an aspect of anamorphic lenses that a lot of other companies ran away from, which is they're inherently, they default to a mode in which they distort, in which a vertical line is not a vertical line, except pretty much for the center of the screen. And most companies work very, very hard and very successfully to remove those distortions so that there's crispness and clear verticals as far out to the edge of the frame as possible. The Koa people don't care about that, not interested in that. They're going old school. They're making lenses that look like those lenses that were made back then, except the close focus is a lot better. And, you know, we did some tests, and I just said, I really like the way these look. It feels of that time, but yet it's not just, and you're right. The good German was an attempt to just literally recreate an aesthetic. This, I wanted to use an aesthetic as like a base, but I wanted like modifiers, you know, around it.
And the vignetting I did notice as well. I was watching this thinking, have you put that in digitally? And then I think I read somewhere that you actually spoke about the vignetting actually being in the lens.
The widest of them.
Yeah, on the wide.
Yeah. So what we ended up having to do in order to match it was to, every time I wasn't using that wide lens, we would digitally create a vignette so that it all felt smooth.
Right.
But
right.
It was something that you couldn't get rid of and that I liked.
I just want to go back to these themes of systemic corruption and corporate foul play that recur in your work, and you know, Aaron Brockovich and The Informant and High Flying Bird, certainly. I'm just wondering what you think the role of cinema and television can be, if it does have a role in enlightening people, in politicizing them.
Yeah, look, I'm hard pressed to point out a film that wasn't a documentary that is, you know, converted public policy. Here's what I do know is that public policy gets changed by the public, and the public gets changed by, you know, cultural conversations, and that movies and television and magazines and all forms of art and communication are part of that culture. And so it can, there, I think you could say that it has the potential to start something. I don't know if it has potential beyond that, but it's certainly my experience that there's a connection to a lot of the larger problems that we're having that can be traced to this issue of corruption, of abuse of power, and a lack of accountability. And also, but we have an obligation, I think, to start looking at the fact that the other thing that's common to a certain kind of corruption is a sort of an economic structure that is extractive. All it does is pull value out of people and out of places, and it puts nothing back, and it creates nothing. And that is, as we're witnessing, there seems to be an algorithm to that in the real world that accelerates over time. And so those are just things that I've noticed. And what I'm interested in is, what is the street level effect of this policy that you would think exists at 60,000 feet, but in point of fact, touches all of us? Like, literally, there isn't, you go out and walk around the city, I guarantee you at some point in that, if that's a functioning, successful city block, you start tracing back the stories of how everybody on that block got on that block and is in that building or whatever, you're going to find something.
Yeah, I dare say you're right. Yeah. Look, I want to ask you, you've been very critical in the past about the film industry, and we've seen such a transformation in recent years, we've seen streaming platforms. I mean, that's not really an adequate way of describing them, but you know what I mean.
Yep.
Places like Amazon, Netflix, becoming the new studios. And you've been working with HBO and Netflix very recently. How do you find, you know, what's the mood in the room like working with these people compared to, say, what the mood in the room was like sort of 10, 20 years ago working with the old studios? Has anything changed? Is it easier to work now when you're making things for streaming platforms? Is it more straightforward? Is it more transparent? Or are there new problems?
Well, I think, look, it's an industry that's always had a high level of fear because of the amount of uncertainty that exists. You put stuff out there, you just don't know what people are going to do or what they're going to say or how they're going to respond until you put it out there. And so the level of uncertainty has a different tone now because of the scale. It used to be the uncertainty revolved almost exclusively around theatrical box office. Like, why are fewer people going to the movies? It costs more to put a movie out. What do we do about these global markets? Like, that was kind of the biggest thing to my mind, in my experience, that people were uncertain about and worried about. Now you've got that. And this other larger thing, which is this entire industry, on the basis of one example, has decided collectively to chase a certain economic model and approach to production and distribution of content that is still in flux in my mind.
You're talking about, like, Netflix.
Yeah, like we don't know enough about their internal economic assumptions to know if they are the success that they appear to be from the outside. Or if they're not, like, I don't know. I don't know what assumptions they make. I just don't.
They're infamously opaque, aren't they? About their
yeah. Look, that's numbers. Their privilege. If I were another large company, before I put all my chips on that being, you know, the version of the business that's going to beat every other version of the business, that would be terrifying. It's one thing to see Star Wars and have Star Wars blow up and become the most successful picture of all time, empirically. And you saying, I want to make something like Star Wars. I get that. In my mind, I haven't seen the, like, empirical, quantifiable, you know, success that I can then go, oh, I understand that now, you know.
Yeah,
now
for the streaming world. Yeah,
that's worth duplicating. All I'm saying is there's a giant question mark in the middle of this huge, you know, migration that makes me anxious, and I think it makes everybody anxious.
Steven Soderbergh, thank you very much for joining me on The Screen Show.
Thank you.
Steven Soderbergh, director of No Sudden Move, which is available to stream on various platforms in Australia. This is The Screen Show on ABC Radio National. My name's Jason DeRosso. French actor and filmmaker Melanie Laurent has just premiered her new movie, The Mad Women's Ball, at the Toronto Film Festival. It's a period thriller about a young woman with psychic powers who's misdiagnosed and committed to a mental hospital. Lou Delage plays the lead character, Eugenie, a fair-skinned bourgeois flower who is callously sectioned by her devout Catholic family into the Women's Mental Hospital of Salpêtrière, where she endures overcrowded lodgings, brutal treatments like ice baths, and the leering gaze of the all-male doctors who use the inmates for their research. Now, as the title suggests, the film culminates in a grotesque annual ball where patients dress in carnival costume to mingle with their keepers. Laurent herself plays the stern governess of the institution. Now, there's a tradition of movies about wrongful imprisonment in the modern era that goes back to prestige films like The Shawshank Redemption that tends to err on the side of the picturesque when presenting the abject realities of prison life or life inside a mental institution like this one, which for all intents and purposes was a kind of prison. And what does strike you about the Mad Women's Ball from the get-go is how pretty it looks. I mean, it's the kind of film where Eugénie's best friend inside the hospital is played by the very photogenic actor, Lemaine de Dietrich. A good actor too, but when her character is subjected to ghastly abuse by a young male doctor, her subsequent descent into madness is chiefly communicated by one of those gestures that just doesn't quite convince on screen. She bends her hand into a kind of strange contortion that remains there permanently just beneath her chin. That said, Laurent is not an unsophisticated filmmaker by any means, as she showed in her 2014 coming-of-age film, Breathe. And putting aside my reservations, I think what this film is doing, well, there are a couple of things it's doing that are very interesting. The first thing is that it makes a surprising attack on the methods of renowned physician Jean-Martin Charcot, who's played by Grégoire Bonnet, a pioneer in the treatment of mental illness. And it also presents Eugénie's psychic powers without any hint of French secular skepticism. The second thing to point out is how the film opens with a sequence that's shot in the streets of Paris, crowded with mourners for Victor Hugo's funeral. This sequence culminates in a shot of a woman from behind glancing back at the camera, aware that she is being watched. And the film subsequently reminds us again and again of the way women are subject to the gaze of others. In particular, how the ramifications of what is essentially a lack of power play out in a male-dominated medical system. I think such ideas are rich inspiration, and the fact that Laurent has chosen to explore them in a slightly glossy period thriller that's part ghost story, part ode to female friendship, is her decision. It's a decision to counterbalance, I think, what might have been a very austere story. The genteel sheen is not to my taste, but I think the trade-off is not without reason. And all in all, The Mad Women's Ball, I think, is reasonably entertaining. The Mad Women's Ball is screening on Amazon Prime Video in Australia. Melanie Laurent is coming up.
Où sommes-nous?
Je ne reconnais pas le...
Oh non, pas ça. Pas la salpêtrière! Pas la salpêtrière! Non, pas ça. Pas ça. Non!
Je n'ai rien à faire ici.
Maman!
Ça, ce n'est pas toi qui le décide. C'est ton père, enfin. C'était ton père.
Maintenant, c'est le docteur Charcot, c'est comme ça.
Melanie Laurent, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you so much. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very curious about this very imposing and sinister institution that you've depicted in this film. I know you spent time in the archives of Salpêtrière, and I was wondering, did the women who were patients at this hospital leave many written accounts of their experiences? Did you find many to draw upon?
I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time there, and probably because it became something extremely modern. It's pretty weird because it's a real big hospital in the middle of Paris. So you really have that sensation of being a prisoner in the middle of the city. And that's why it's probably terrible, because I felt like a lot of women being dropped there and couldn't imagine that they were going there. And when you see the place right now today, it's just like it's a small, tiny building, you know, and it feels claustrophobic. And then I went there physically and I really hated all those vibes. So I just quickly left that terrible place, because there is still like a sort of like misunderstanding, I feel, even today, about madness. You know, I don't think and I don't feel that we just totally solve and we are totally taking care of all those people. What was shocking and horrifying for me was to go on the research and go deeper in that period of time and just realized they were not really mad. They were like more traumatized than mad. And that was extremely shocking because when I read all those diagnostics of that famous, very famous doctor called Charcot, who left a very interesting and powerful trace as a doctor and a neurologue, I just realized he was more into the effect more than the cause. So every patient arrived and he didn't really care about why. He just wanted to use their fragility and their, not craziness, but their anger or the anger or those crises to make experience, which was absolutely disgusting when you think about it.
Yeah, because he's, I mean, like a lot of figures in the history of medicine, he's held up as this very, this sort of male genius, I suppose. And he has this huge, he's left a huge legacy, of course, when it comes to mental illness. But your film is all about exploring how his legacy affected, well, not even his legacy, but how his practice affected the women that he treated. And often these women were actually the subject of his experiments.
Yeah, but also the movie really doesn't talk about that specific guy. And I think that was maybe more complicating for me because I didn't have enough time to really ask myself, do I like him? What sort of image I want to give to the audience? And I just took, instead of making him as a monster, I just make him, I think in the movie, very distant from humanity, you know? But he seems to be, what we're going to say, a doctor who knows what he's doing. I think he really left over the idea of knowing what they feel and going, he would have gone way far if he just like observe the reason of those crises. And he was very criticized, by the way, at that period of time, because he was very successful and he had a lot of money and he was in his office with a monkey and exotic birds and he was a little bit eccentric. And I feel like that sort of small zoo that he had in his own office was kind of like what he had in his own hospital in a way. And that's why when I started to make the research, I really didn't like him. So, yeah.
And your film sort of does point out what you're saying. It illustrates what you're saying, which is, I mean, there were women there who were traumatized from being sexually abused or yes, abused in other ways, and quite understandably, and in some cases, the very severe treatment led them to become more sick, more ill within the walls of this imposing mental hospital.
Yeah, and I think the worst is the hydrotherapy. Those cold baths when you could have when you literally could have died because the prison itself was so cold and humid, going to those baths 3 or 4 times a week was like a disaster for the body, and pneumonia and all those diseases. So yeah, there is something about absurdity and all those movies make us sick when we watch them because you know how unfair it is, especially when you have the subjectivity from today and when you can take a step back. It's really like the violence and the idea of every woman who just wanted to stand up or say something, if they just like were like a little bit too aggressive, was going to those cold baths, which is, by the way, a great method if you think about it, because you put anyone who's having a crisis in a cold bath and it stops immediately, and then you it takes hours and even like days to recover from a very, very cold bath, which is so unfair and tragic because they couldn't speak and they couldn't be against anything they were like getting there, and the only answer for that was bath, and I really wanted to portray that, and because there is something about screaming before being in the silent, because your body stops. And I think it's also very powerful as an image, obviously, and as a symbol, how you just like make all those women shut up.
Yeah. He reminded me, I know he is a distant figure in some ways, but I just want to point on this observation I had, that he reminded me a little bit of, there's a parallel here with how male directors sometimes are, I imagine. And I don't know if you were drawing that parallel. There's a moment where he is showing off one of his patients and hypnotizing her and making her do these actions with that have a slight erotic dimension, I would argue.
Yeah.
And this is for an audience of male, you know, physicians watching on, male medics. And I thought in that moment, wow, is this Melanie Laurent almost making a kind of veiled parallel with the male-dominated film industry?
Let's say that I didn't think about that, but I was shocked when I saw a painting about Charcot. And there is one very famous painting of him. And it's obviously not the reality, because when you do a painting, especially at that period of time, it's like a pure mise-en-scène also. But he was literally God in the middle of the painting, and a woman half naked was almost like falling, and all those men with suits smoking cigar and with like watching that half naked woman. And more I was reading about that period, and more I realized we were talking about peep show. We were talking about like pornography. Like imagine how many women were just like showed at extremely fragile woman who just totally insane and crazy, and all those men who just like looking at them. Yeah. It was like, yeah, that. So I didn't thought about like that symbol or parable of industry, but I really definitely thought about how crazy it was to have like only men who was together, old men together, watching young women half naked on the floor, moving and screaming. And
yes, and being very manipulated physically, I think, as well, and psychologically, of course.
The worst also is because when they were like picked by Charcot, they felt extremely honored, because they were like in the middle and in the center of all those looks, and Charcot had like a sort of a big power. So that's the also absurdity of it.
Can I ask you, though, you haven't chosen to center this story around a character who is there because she's necessarily been physically abused in some way. The key point about this character is that she has psychic abilities. And I found that a really interesting choice because, I mean, France is known for being a very secular society and so forth, and Charcot represents that secular kind of French identity in a way. But you've chosen to place this woman in opposition to him, really, within the film, and to all that established, all that he represents, really. And you do that in a way that's not skeptical at all when it comes to her psychic abilities and her supposed abilities to talk to the dead. You're not skeptical about this in the film. Tell me about that choice.
Well, the book, because it's a book, the book was literally talking about spirits. They were like in the room. And more than that, they were like smell, like you could, she was describing those spirits with the smell. So a perfume was arriving in the room, and then you could see like some trace on the couch. And they were here, they were so present in the book. And then that was obviously the first question I asked myself. And I had like a very quick answer. I didn't want to make a genre movie, and I didn't want to make a movie about ghosts, and I didn't want to make a movie about spirits. I wanted to be septic first, and I wanted also to offer the audience to have so many layers of reading.
Because she could be schizophrenic or something. Yeah. But you haven't, the film doesn't judge her, and in fact it suggests that perhaps her powers are real.
Yeah, I think it's a movie about belief, you know, and then it's and thank God in 2021 in France, at least, you can choose to believe or not. And I really wanted to offer the audience to choose what you want to do, because I feel like if you're very religious, you really watch that movie in a totally different way than if you're not. And if you believe in spirits, there is a total other reading than if you're extremely skeptical. And I think it's rare in movies, and it's rare to have that opportunity to do that as a director, to be like, you're not going to see another movie if you feel this or this or this. It's just up to you and up to what you feel to just follow her or not. But to me, for example, who didn't see any ghost and spirit and who's probably a little bit skeptic about that version of it, I'm kind of like Genevieve. I'm very rational. And this is
your character, Genevieve, who's the governess of this hospital. Yeah, you're like her.
Who has a father who's a doctor who works as a nurse there, and she doesn't want to believe in anything of it, but she lost someone, and she's miserable, and her sister is missing, and she cannot leave because she doesn't have access to her anymore. And she's so stubborn and she's so skeptic and she's so against everything. There is a scene when she's trying to go to a church and she's trying to looking for something and nothing's happening. But for me in the movie, at some point they're going to talk. And for me, she doesn't believe it. She doesn't believe her. I think it's just so nice to maybe believe. And I think the movie talks also about that. And that's why I really didn't want to see any of those spirits on screen. And I thought about Beautiful from Inarritu, and I remember how he magistrally chose to show the gift, show some spirits, but that was really like background. And I remember the genius of it saying, like, if you see it, it's because you're very attentive to the shot, but if you don't see it, you're not going to miss anything either. So yeah, that was really exciting as a director to make those choices and going to that path instead of another one.
Melanie Laurent, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you.
Filmmaker and actor Melanie Laurent, The Mad Women's Ball is available to stream on Amazon Prime. You're listening to The Screen Show on ABC Radio National with me, Jason DeRosso. The Emmys this week delivered many accolades for The Crown, that series about the British royal family, including Best Director for the New Zealand-born Jessica Hobbs and her work on the season finale. I caught up with Hobbs a few months ago on the show. She's an industry veteran who is very insightful when talking about her craft, and we thought it was a great opportunity to play some of that chat for you again today. We're going to play a clip from The Crown first, the episode that won her the Emmy, and then you'll meet her, Jessica Hobbs, coming up.
The exquisite selfishness of your motives and the calculated vulgarity of the antics, knowing full well the headlines they would get.
Antics?
Grandstanding, like that. We think we couldn't do that to theatrically hug the wretched and the dispossessed and cover ourselves in glory all over the front pages.
I doubt it. You barely find it in yourselves to hug your own.
I hug who I want to. I hug who I love. Particularly when they are affected by the selfishness of others and need tearing up.
Who are you referring to?
Camilla.
Why would I care about her?
Because I care about her! Morning, noon, and night I care about her! And you've hurt her. And if you hurt her, you hurt me.
Jessica Hobbs, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you.
Now, another finale. You've directed three of the episodes of this season, but you directed, and one of which is the finale, and you directed the finale of season three as well. Is there a logic behind who gets assigned each episode, or do you get to pick? I'd read somewhere that you got to pick on the previous season.
I did, and the season just gone past. Because, I mean, Peter's very good with all of us. He really wanted me to do, and I really wanted to do, the Helena episode, the Princess Margaret episode. And then the last two were such a great pair. And so he was very happy with that previous finale, and I'd had a great time doing it. And I like, endings are good, you know. You get to do a lot of great meaty material. So I know that that's often a good place to aim. So I was quite happy to do it. And he pitched it to me, and by the time he pitched it, you know, the whole demise of Thatcher and what was going on with Charles and Diana, I was like, yeah, I'm in.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that episode 7, which is where you parachute into this season, is all about Helena Bonham Carter's Princess Margaret. You have worked with her previously, including a very moving episode in the previous season where, let's put it this way, she grapples with her demons and there is deep mental illness issues. Tell me about revisiting that character. I mean, is this the character with whom you've dived most deep?
I would say with her and probably with Prince Philip on the Moon Dust episode. I really love these, you know, kind of tiny cul-de-sac episodes where you get to follow just a very personal journey that's almost outside the family, and they're bigger notions of sense of self and faith and culpability rather than the bigger stage. So I really enjoy those personal ones.
Yeah, and Princess Margaret, of course, as we've said, goes through some of the, you know, the rockiest moments of all the characters, I think. Tell me about your approach to dealing with her personal demons with the actor, Helena Bonham Carter.
Well, Helena and I spoke a lot about the vulnerability that we perceived she felt. Imagine growing up always knowing that you're only ever second in line for everything, you know, that is your life path. And even if you're a very well-adjusted person, it's difficult. But if you're a shining, big, expressive personality, that's quite a big ask. Helena herself related to it very strongly. I mean, I really love what she does in the first scene with the psychiatrist, where she's being deflective, deflective, deflective. She's not even interested. And then you just see her start to wobble slightly. You just hear that tiny little crack in her voice, and you can see it on the side of her face. And I just found that incredibly moving. It's because Helena herself can relate and understand to that level of vulnerability. So we talked about that. And a lot of it's about leaving space for the actor to have the time to find those moments, you know, just letting the takes play out and giving as long as she needs to between lines or things. It's just, particularly with her, I learned not to have a predetermined rhythm in my head, just to kind of go at whatever rhythm was coming through for her. And that was a really good, I felt we got better at working together the more we worked.
I mean, it's interesting because those scenes like the one you mentioned with the psychiatrist, are some of the simplest scenes from a technical point of view. But are they the ones that, for you as a director, sometimes give you more satisfaction?
Well, definitely. I think, you know, it's that sense where you're, and this is what you always want when action is called and you're watching something, where you just transcend, you forget about what you're making, you're just watching something happen in front of you. And I remember when that happened in the room on that day, and I felt tears prick in my eyes, and I thought, oh God, the pain for this woman. And then I thought, we've got that now.
How do you parachute into a show like this where, I mean, I know you were sort of helping to usher in these actors into this generation of the show in the previous season, but you know, you're not directing all of the episodes. And so how is it sort of parachuting in when they've been working with other directors and perhaps they've developed other tics or other little bits that are part of the impersonation or the impression of these real life figures? I mean, do you sometimes have to deal with inheriting other people's work or other people's thinking?
Well, the actors, you know, are ultimately responsible for the characters themselves, but I will try to find ways just to just loosen the jar a little bit so they're not so conscious of their physicality and they can be in that moment more, which is what you're always reaching for. And often it's just giving them the confidence that they're already there, that they don't need to be monitoring themselves.
I want to ask you about that sort of tragic element of this show, because it is such a sort of unfolding tragedy in many ways. It strikes me that it is a show about people suffering alone. And I'm thinking of Thatcher's panic attack in the bedroom after the party revolt, you know, Diana's eating disorder, a lot of shots of people in cars alone. And of course, the finale for which you were nominated for an Emmy of the previous season is this shot of Coleman as Queen Elizabeth in the royal carriage alone, centre of frame, an extended shot, surrounded by people in a sort of huge, you know, line of men on horses and so forth, including her son, through the back window that we could catch glimpses of. But she is terribly alone. Is that the key to the tragedy, do you think, that it's people surrounded by so many others, but they're fundamentally alone in facing their deepest challenges?
I think those positions in society can be very isolated. And I think we elevate people into these positions and we have enormous expectations of them, but then they become representational. And I think within that, there's a real isolation and loneliness that comes out of it. I also have to hold my hand up and say, a lot of my work has that theme, not just in The Crown. I'm really curious and interested in shining a light on loneliness. I think that that's something that is a universal experience, and sometimes through the medium of television, you can reach people in their living rooms and hopefully enable them to feel less alone through someone else's experience.
Can I ask you about the freedom you've got to work on The Crown? Because I have read you say that Peter Morgan, the showrunner, has said that you can bring a lot to it. He gives a lot of freedom to the directors. And so, yes, I'd like you to talk, if you could, to this idea of the freedom that directors are given on The Crown by Peter Morgan.
Peter's an incredibly generous showrunner and creator in that his scripts are extremely muscular. They have very deep thematics running through them, and they're very economical in the way they're written. They're quite muscular, but it means that there's a lot of room, and often necessary room, for you to find as a director to pull out, you know, what we often refer to sometimes jokingly as the connective tissue. What are the moments that lead to those big moments that he's written? So you have these epic scenes, these extraordinary standoffs between people, and what I'm interested in is, how does that person feel just when they leave that room or before they enter that room, or what might be a moment alone with that character that I could create? And he said to me on the first season I did with him, I love surprises. So I was like, okay. And there's a bit in the finale of season three where she's dancing in Mystique with her friends, and she sees her husband, Tony Armstrong-Jones, watching her, or thinks she does, and then realizes he's not there. And that wasn't in the script. That was just something I came up with when we were there. I saw Ben Daniels in the bar and said to the first AD, could we do this tomorrow? I've just had this idea, but it might not work, and blah, blah, blah. And I was really nervous about showing Peter, showed it to him in the cutting room, and he went, I love that. And I was like, okay. And that, I think, started our relationship in terms of, you know, there's a dance that happens between Dazzle, the priest, and Margaret when they dance to Bowie's Let's Dance at the beginning. That wasn't scripted. That was something I wanted to do with the actors on the day, because I thought it was a big ask for the audience to understand this level of friendship between this man and this woman. And in order to feel the puncture of her making a move on him and him rejecting her, I was like, what fun can we have beforehand? So I said to the actors, look, this was actually very much of the time. I know that she liked it. You know, I had the kind of music supervisor working with me, and they were so brilliant.
So you knew that Margaret liked David Bowie in that era?
I knew that song, yep, that she had enough of a connection to contemporary music that I wasn't reaching too far. Mm. And I also knew from Dazzle, because he was really into music, so that was one of their big connective loves together. So I thought, I think this is okay, we can do this. He was quite, you know, he was also very into opera, but that was a big track at that time, so I felt safe for putting it in.
Well, it's an interesting...
And I love the way the actors responded.
They respond wonderfully well, and as they dance to Let's Dance, David Bowie's famous hit, it's very much a flirtatious sort of moment, isn't it? You're cutting between them, and it's almost the foreplay. Well, she's reading it as foreplay, and he's much more innocent.
He's just, well, he is and he isn't. And it was interesting, because I read a lot about that, the actual priest that was her great friend, because they did have a terrible falling out and didn't speak again. And he, you know, he was brilliant fun and heavily flirtatious with her, according to other friends of his. And that was difficult for her. So, you know, because she's so isolated, it's hard, you know, your antenna starts to go. And I just wanted to give her the space for us as an audience to forget ourselves, to have some fun in the moment. So when she was doing it, we could kind of go with it rather than just start them on a couch with her perhaps being predatory. So I was just finding those spaces. And I think to work with a writer who is open to you contributing like that is a brilliant thing.
Director Jessica Hobbs, who won an Emmy this week for her work on The Crown, which is streaming over at Netflix. And you can find the longer version of that chat at our website, The Screen Show website. I'm Jason DeRosso. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.